Hello and welcome to episode 33 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, Boardman has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that Boardman and my name is Graham Lee. Now, this time I've actually had some listener feedback on topics that you would like covered. So thank you very much to Twitter user Sharplet, Adam Sharp, who has asked a collection of questions. And of course, anyone else who wants to ask me questions to cover on the podcast or topics that you think would be interesting, please do just get in touch. You can email grahamlee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter, iwaslg, iwaslweg. You can find me as leeg at mastodon.social as well. Anywhere else that you know I hang out, you feel welcome to get in touch. So I'm going to take the three questions that Sharplet asked, and I'm going to take them in order of brevity of response, basically from shortest to longest, because that gives me most time to prepare my answer for the longer question. So, question one. What's the name of the tune you play for the podcast intro? It is called The Blue-Eyed Stranger. It is a Cotswold Morris dancing tune, and it is also a song. Lyrics go something like, "The blue-eyed stranger shuffled into town with his fiddle slung over his shoulder. Oh, he seemed so shy that he caught the maiden's eye, but in truth he was very much bolder. Oh, I have blue eyes." It's a nice tune. That's basically why I chose it. Question two. How did you find a university sponsoring software engineering research as opposed to CS, computer science? So this is quite an interesting thing. There is a very small amount of software engineering research in the world, and a lot of it is not particularly interesting. If you look at Derek Jones's book, Evidence-Based Software Engineering Using R, he covers pretty much every study in empirical software engineering he could find where the data was publicly available, and the book is about 600 pages long. Every study in a 600 page book. So software engineering is not particularly well researched. Certainly not. Neither qualitatively nor quantitatively. Quantitatively is obviously numeric, but it also is usually deductive. It's the sort of Popperian view of science, where you have a hypothesis and you, as a dispassionate observer, try to gather data that falsifies that hypothesis, that shows that it can't hold. Whereas there's a broader collection of paradigms in qualitative research, which are more to do with how people, individuals or groups see themselves and their relations with a system with which they interact or in which they are embedded. And both of these are appropriate to workplace research, and both of them are appropriate to software engineering, because software engineering is a research. Is a workplace. So there are a couple of academics in Oxford who are paid as software engineers and have a chair in there is a chair in software engineering, but they are on the teaching side primarily, because we have a professional master's course, which I actually took, a Master's of Science in Software Engineering, and the former director of that program has the Software Engineering Chair in Computer Science. And a lot of the other academics who contribute significantly to that program are basically sort of paid to run that program, even if they have research interests, main career or side show research interests. So my PhD, which is on software engineering, is actually studying my job, which is a research software engineer, And in fact, I am not on any contract as a software engineering researcher, nor am I, like, you know, nor is my studentship as a software engineering researcher. It's as a computer science researcher. But a collaboration between computer science, well, two groups within computer science, the Research Software Engineering Group, which is the one I work in, the Human-Centered Computing Group, which is the sort of interdisciplinary qualitative group that looks at usability and impact of security features, broader sort of responsibility in research and innovation as it relates to ICT, perceptions and reality of bias and ethical issues in artificial intelligence and so on. And finally, the Oxford eResearch Centre, which is actually a part of the engineering department. Anyway, what I am asking, my research question is, fundamentally, is it appropriate for people writing software in research domains in academia to just take ideas and practices from commercial software engineering and just try applying them and apply them more? You know, there's this idea that the reason that software is in a bad state in research is because you're just not software engineering hard enough. And I'm asking, is that actually true? So the university is effectively, well, I mean, the university has not made any decisions at all. There's a point I often make about academic life is that because there's this idea of academic freedom, and, you know, as long as you're sort of getting the funding and not bringing anyone into disrepute, you are responsible for your own career and your own program of work. There is a very diffuse set of responsibilities. So it's not like there's a CEO of Oxford University who said, we need software engineers. You're the CTO of Oxford University. Your job is to, like, do more software engineering. And then that CTO has gone to the VP of software engineering and said, you need to do more software. That chain of command, that structure doesn't exist. Like, the cybernetics of a university or of academia are very different from the cybernetics of a commercial business, of a capitalist organization. So what there is instead is someone who is one of my DPhil supervisors and effectively my line manager in my job, decided we need to do a better job of software engineering in the university. I'm going to, like, ask around for money to hire some software engineers. Went to the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council and managed to get some funding. Hired a couple of software engineers for a year. Did some work that proved to be useful. Got some more money for another year. Hired a few more people, one of whom was me. And, you know, this is kind of going on this basis. And we're in the process of renegotiating that business case so that we can apply for sort of more sustainable funding, rather than saying every year, hey, turns out we still need some software, can we have some more money? You know, saying, can we just underwrite this thing because we know that the projects will come in? So the university, in fact, is not directly sponsoring software engineering. The Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council are in this instance. But this is part of a growing movement within academia, particularly advanced in the UK, because there were some early, like, you know, influential people who decided this was important and got behind it and started promoting it. This movement called research software engineering, which is the idea of understanding the contribution that custom software development brings to advanced research, or to the capability of doing research at all in a lot of domains, and recognizing that contribution, rewarding that contribution, and improving that capability. As I say, mostly advanced in the UK. The US also has a research software engineering movement, as do a few other countries, Germany and the Netherlands. And you know, maybe there are more worldwide as well. But this whole concept that you would pay people not at, you know, to contribute to research, but not like just measure them on how many papers they are the author on, is like fairly hard to get across in an academic context. You know, that libraries are understood, IT support departments are understood, facilities management, buildings are understood. Moving that out into new areas is pretty difficult. And it's because of this diffuse responsibility I was talking about before, that in order to get sort of social change in this like distributed consensus making organization, you need to get distributed consensus, which means you need to get everyone to agree. On the other hand, you can get local nodes because it's so distributed. So you can have a group that hires a software engineer and just like doesn't tell anybody else, or it doesn't need to ask anybody else's permission and just gets on with it. But getting everybody to do that, getting like, you know, infrastructural projects, getting sector-wide agreement or national agreement or institutional agreement, requires a lot of work, and it's got you've got to be sort of pushing for the question to be asked and demonstrating the answer at the same time. So a lot of people in positions like mine, research software engineering, like contracts, are fairly precarious because we're still being measured on how many publications do you write, you know, how far up the academic hierarchy have you done, how many conferences you've spoken at, and the answer is like none. Although actually I am speaking at a conference on the 4th of June, so maybe if you are very lucky and one of the first few people to listen to this, it won't have gone out yet. But for most people, that will be in the past. But yeah, like by and large, we are the people who are hired into one role in order to do another role and have to try and succeed at the second role while also demonstrating the benefit of the second role, whilst not getting asked too many questions about why we're not doing so well at the first role. And that's kind of how change has to work in universities. So that was, I think, the second longest answer that I had to one of these questions. The third, again, this was asked by Adam Sharp, Twitter user Sharplet, is, do you think the growing amount of free source packages available online devalues programming or software engineering labour? Well, yes. I don't think it's a straightforward yes. I think that there is a lot going on here and we need to unpack it. So, does the availability of free software reduce labour costs in software engineering? Well, there's a bunch of things that like look like they ought to reduce labour costs in software engineering, and yet salaries in software engineering are still incredibly high depending on where you are geographically. So I think that the median salary in the UK, or sorry, the median household income in the UK, I think is about £28,000. And I have definitely been paid four times that much in a software engineering role before, and was only a little way up the seniority ladder in that company. So there is a lot more money than the median UK household income available in software engineering. In like the US, prices vary crazily by location in the US, and you know, this has caused problems during the COVID-19 crisis, where people who have realized that they don't need to be in the office to work anymore have tried to keep their Silicon Valley salary and move to, you know, the breadbasket, move to like North Carolina or somewhere, and have been
told, well, we're going to pay you less because it costs way less to live. So, you know, salaries are ridiculously high. I think that for one Silicon Valley firm, I worked in a what they called an engineer grade 3, which is basically someone straight out of university, new hired, no experience, was paid more if they were in Silicon Valley than my salary as a senior engineer and like entry-level engineering manager in their office in London. And London costs more than the rest of the UK. So there are very high salaries, there are also very high costs of living. But remember that the high cost of living in Silicon Valley is due to the concentration of people who expect high salaries, which then allows the rents to go up, which then absorbs those salaries, which then means that they have to go up. You know, so it's a kind of like positive feedback problem that is like just a local failure of the supposed writing factor of the invisible hand. So, despite these ridiculously high salaries, there are various pressures on salaries downwards. One is the collusion between these companies in terms of non-compete, no hiring, no competitive hiring, no hiring away, no taking your staff from one company to another when you when a director moves or whatever. That these companies put in place that occasionally get busted for. Apple and Google were famously slapped by the regulators for doing this a number of years ago. It carries on and just isn't detected in every case by the legal by the lawyers or by the regulators. So that acts to push costs down. The availability of lower paid workers elsewhere, who may still be, given a good standard of living, just like the cost of a good standard of living is lower elsewhere, puts prices down. You could imagine, thinking, even if you're a company based in Palo Alto, no, I don't need to hire a someone who lives in a $3,500 a month shoebox in San Francisco. I'm going to hire someone from Iowa or offshore. Offshoring was a big sort of innovation in the 90s as the internet started to become adopted. And so you could also say, well, what if they live in Calcutta or Bangalore or Budapest or Warsaw, somewhere where, again, the cost of living is a lot lower. There's also sort of currency differences that make it favorable to pay people. Maybe there's tax differences as well. So that acts to lower cost. And then there's hobbyists. And so, we come on to the idea of open source software that, you could pay software engineers to build a thing for you, or you could just find the NPM module that already does it and incorporate that. And if it doesn't do the thing that you want and nobody within the company can make it do the thing you want, or it would cost too much to get them to do it, then just make it sufficiently interesting to a student with too much time on their hands and let them do it for free. And so there's, that should be another downward pressure on price. What we actually see, though, is that the existence of free software sometimes motivates people to produce alternatives and to pay for them. So the one of the greatest advances in the employment of infrastructural software engineers, of people building low-level components for basic computing in recent history, has been the introduction of the GPL version 3 and the AGPL version 3, because that meant that every company who believed in their right to patent software suddenly hired software engineers to work on LLVM, because they could no longer use GCC. Look at Apple's investment in LLVM and their hiring of Chris Lattner. That came about because they preferred the license of LLVM to the license of GCC. Their replacement in recent versions of Mac OS X of Bash with Zshell, or Zshell, I suppose, came about because their version of Bash was embarrassingly out of date because it was the last GPL2 version of Bash. You could carry on listing projects like this. Linux has survived because Linux literally cannot move its license away from GPL version 2, both because Linus Torvalds doesn't want to, and because they never had copyright assignments, so it's not their choice. You know, they'd have to contact a load of people, or maybe the estates of some of those people, because some of the contributors will have died, and say, right, there's this really complicated thing in software engineering, and I know that you're grieving because your wife died 3 years ago, but we really need to know, are you interested, are you willing to relicense her contributions to the Linux kernel under the terms of this other license instead of that license? So, like, Linux, that's never going to happen. And that means that corporations are happy to carry on investing in Linux. But there's a bunch of projects where it has happened. And because companies are deliberately trying to use the GPL version 3 and the AGPL version 3 as a sort of licensing firebreak. So companies like MongoDB and Neo4j and like various infrastructural companies will say, we are releasing this thing as free software under the GPL version 3 or the AGPL version 3 because they get the benefits of being open source. It's, there's kudos, there's community engagement, and then there's grassroots adoption, which then influences the choices that are made in startups, and then there's startup successes which influence the choices that are made in larger enterprises and so on. So there's a network effect in having this free software. But the way they see it is that nobody else can compete with their hosted service, because if they make a hosted service, they have to open source it, which means that if they make it any better, then the originating company can hoist back those changes and thus close the gap, and so there's no way for an alternative provider to differentiate. But look what happens instead. Because the value in the technology sector has all been consolidated into the few large companies, the sort of Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon collection of companies. You might consider Facebook in that group as well. When they find someone else's product that is GPL version 3 or AGPL version 3 that they want to include in their offering and can't because they're allergic to the license, they just hire a bunch of software engineers to go and re-implement it. So you see Amazon doing this all the time with their sort of MongoDB compatible database or their Elastic compatible search service, which are exactly API compatible because the Open Source Foundation's never patent anything, because the free software approach to software patents is incorrect, which is a topic for another time. So it becomes easy for them to re-implement this software just by throwing a bunch of software engineers at the problem. So on the one hand, you've got, we don't need to throw software engineers at the problem because we can just take this MIT licensed NPM module that already does what we want. On the other hand, you've got companies saying, we can't use this GPL version 3 licensed module because we're allergic to restrictions on software patents. Therefore, we are going to hire software engineers to re-implement this free software. So it's kind of working both ways. But I think the net result is that there is a lot less software being written in the world thanks to the combination of free software and the internet. That's not to say there isn't still a lot of custom software being written, but that custom software is largely glue and string. It's largely take an open source database, take an open source language runtime, take an open source object relational mapper, take an open source web framework, take an open source CSS framework and glue those together so that they do the thing that I want. Which is itself interesting because it means that we've commoditized all of the like generic computery bits and haven't commoditized the things on top. Like, but, you know, I'm not saying take an open source inventory management system. I'm saying take an open source database and ORM. I'm not saying take an open source like theater reservations system. I'm saying take an open source database and web framework. You know, we've done commoditized the general bits, and we haven't gone particularly far, I would say, in many verticals outside of software development tools in terms of like providing standard open source stacks. You know, you could maybe look at CRMs where there are a bunch of open source CRMs, but then there's also Salesforce who is still able to compete. So there's nothing that's really, nothing has undercut the business of running a service on a computer, whether it's as a SaaS or through an application. But a lot has undercut the business of trying to like create general purpose utility out of computing. That has been completely eaten by open source. But let's go back to the you know, the sort of progenitor of the free software movement, to Richard Stallman. And he did address in the sort of early phase of the Free Software Foundation and the free software movement, he did address this idea of, well, aren't you just saying that like nobody should get paid to work in software? And he said, no, very much the opposite. People should get paid to work on software, but people should get paid for making a contribution in software. When you've got proprietary software, like a bunch of people can get paid for basically doing the same thing, for repeating redundant work, because they don't get to learn from each other. They don't get to share each other's implementations or ideas. They don't get to advance the state of the art. Imagine that we didn't have any open source software at all, and you wanted to build your theatre reservation system. The first thing you'd have to do is either write a database or license a commercial database. So you know, a bunch of your money would go out to the business of like retrieving and storing data on fixed storage on a computer, which is a problem that was solved, like, you know, well, I mean, the Colossus, like the first electronic computer built in Britain, had like permanent storage. It had a paper tape reader. So like, this is a problem that's actually older than software, actually older than computers, that you would be paying to re-implement over and over for any application. So he's saying, like, don't charge people for that. Charge people for adding value, for adding utility, for doing something new, for like fixing a bug in a common like shared database service, or for adding a feature that's needed in this application, or for customizing an application to fit their use case and their needs, not for rubber stamping the same solution out over and over again. So he was not, you know, the free software movement is not itself against people making money. It's against the accumulation of money by people who aren't contributing to society. So it is anti-capitalist. It is not anti-economics. The you are allowed to get paid for what you do, and if what you do is contribute software, then you are getting paid for contributing software. There is no problem with that. But that contribution of software has to be a contribution to the social commons. It has to be a contribution to the benefit of society. One might almost say that the free software movement is an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. So There would probably be fewer software engineers, perhaps, in a world that worked that way. Or there would be no sort of permanent standing army of software engineers, because you would take someone to do some piece of work at the point where that work was needed, but then you would have that artifact, you would have that contribution, you wouldn't need to carry on like employing people just to build your version of the online storefront or your version of the inventory management system or whatever it is that that you need. Would they be paid less or more? Well, it's hard to predict because the forces would be very different. You know, the, like I say, the reasons for hiring them would be very different. The quality and condition of the work would be very different. If this stuff is for the social good, then you would expect it to be high quality, because you couldn't just like hire people to create some like, you know, buggy database app and then find that it's cheaper to carry on hiring those people to fix bugs than it is to go off and get some like a higher quality piece of software. So you would not need a team of people whose job it is to write your sort of Java storage management library, because you would use everybody's Java storage management library. Or, you know, maybe we collectively wouldn't have Java, but Java is a free software runtime, so, you know, maybe we would. Who knows? It would be a very different world, but it wouldn't be a world in which nobody could get paid for writing software. But because we are in the world in which we do inhabit, because we are in this world where most people have to basically swap their waking time for the right to the necessities of subsistence, to basically give up their time in return for shelter and food and fuel and so on. We're in a situation where there is a reduction in value due to the availability of the social commons, because these social commons can be exploited by the people who are taking the labour power. This is actually a feature, not a bug, of free software. Like, Freedom Zero is the freedom to use the software for any purpose. So if you want to avoid that, if you want to produce a social commons in which the exploiters don't have a role and don't derive benefit, then what you have to do is to develop software that just doesn't work for them, that encodes other values so that it is not useful to the people that you don't want to use it, and then give them the freedom to use it, because it either changes their like mode of operation such that they can no longer exploit the producers, or it's of no use to them and they have to ignore it, and then they have to spend money on catching up with the commons. Or you make it like intolerable to them by encoding the freedoms in such a way that they also have to share those freedoms with other people. And that is the key advantage of the GPL version 3 and the AGPL version 3, is that it forces everybody else to use the GPL version 3 and the AGPL version 3. And when that happens, you very quickly find out who your friends are. You very quickly find out that the people who are in support of free software and open source as either a human rights movement, as the Free Software Foundation would have it, or as an intellectual pursuit, or as a sort of, you know, a goal of knowledge sharing, the people who believe in that movement are the people who can adopt the license and can adopt the software, because their development and everybody else's development is enabled by it, And those who cannot are those who don't share that enjoyment and would rather be given the choice to opt out that is allowed by a permissive license or a non-copyleft license like the MIT or BSD license, that basically says, I give you this freedom and you do not have to give it to anybody else. When you make the difference between I give you this freedom and in return you give everybody this freedom, and I give you this freedom and you do not have to do the same, you very quickly find out who is interested in freedom. So that's where I'm going to end. I'm going to once again thank Adam Sharp, Sharplet on Twitter, for those questions. And I'm going to thank you all for listening and invite you to ask your own questions or to make any comments on what I've said today. Like, let's actually turn this into a discussion rather than a bored man with access to a microphone. GrahamLee@acm.org, Twitter, IwasLeeG, IWASLEEG. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you again soon.